This is going to be very informal. I'm not particularly well prepared, in particular, I should warn you. So what I want to talk about today, what I'll try talking about today, I don't know how far I'll get, but I'll do my best, is to first of all tell you about the infimum definition of quasi-local mass, and then I'll resume, essentially, the program that I was working on in the last lecture, where I summarised the various properties of various definitions of quasi-local mass, at least that I know, that satisfy the at least some sort of positivity condition. Those being, to my mind, the most important conditions. Okay, so we had the infimum definition, which I apologise to those of you who have seen it before. So we're trying to define we're given a region, omega, a bounded manifold, and it's going to come with a metric, g, or g sub omega, which will be only primarily interested in its structure on the boundary, and if I'd leave it like that, then that should be enough. So we can consider alternatively the boundary, and that comes with the induced metric G sigma and an induced mean curvature H sigma. And if I'm talking about a space-time version, then there'll be a few more pieces of data which I'll describe later on. Okay, so now if we want to define the quasi-local mass, we look at the set of all positive mass extensions of this region. So, for example, we have one condition that we're going to need is that we have non-negative scalar curvature. With this set PM0, we're looking at the set of asymptotically flat scalar curvature greater than or equal to 0, complete. Now, the completeness condition can be weakened. In particular, you can allow black holes in the interior of omega, or you can allow black holes out completely exterior to omega. This is probably best if we just leave those sort of complications aside. Now, where have we got a duster? So let's assume it's complete. And the zero refers to the fact that we're going to assume that there are no black holes. So the point being is that these are data sets on which we can actually prove the positive mass theorem. So in particular, the ADM mass of anything in this collection is going to be non-negative, and I've left off a condition here, rather important. When I use subsets for manifolds, I always will mean that they're isometric. Okay, so we have the definition. The positive mass theorem now applies. And it's actually equal to zero if and only if we can embed it isometrically into flat space. So at least one direction there is obvious, the other direction is not. The other implication, if the mass is actually equal to zero, requires a much more subtle argument, which is due to Gerhardt. The conclusion is not quite as strong as one would like. That is, it's not quite that you've got embedding into R3. One gets instead embedding into a locally flat manifold, which I guess could cover parts of R3. So the first one, so we have at least the first property. Actually, I'll put the properties in the wrong order here. There is, of course, another property that is satisfied automatically by the definition. Just from the way we've constructed it, the mass is always going to be well defined. I guess I've phrased this slightly inaccurately, in that the definition should include the condition that Omega's bounded manifold contained in some element of PM0, because that then ensures that you have a finite infimum. But let's leave it as is. So we have condition 0, which says that it's possible to actually define this. It's actually defined on a very general class of manifolds.
Is it known that, to what extent is that problem known, given a domain
There's no general theorem, no. In fact, actually, that's an interesting question. There are certainly constructions which work in many special cases. For example, the quasi-spherical method can be used to construct plenty of examples. In fact, that's perhaps the easy part. The real hard question is the converse. If you're given a region or a boundary set, can you find an omega satisfying this non-negative scalar curvature? And that's really hard. The important thing is that if I actually set it up so that the definition includes, well, okay, so probably best to phrase it in the following way. If you've got just one extension, then the infimum is well defined. So if you're looking for a condition which says that this definition can be implied, then the condition is that there exists one extension, and then you have the mass well defined. The reason why I phrase this in rather a peculiar way is because some of the other definitions, well, essentially all the definitions have some sort of restrictions on the sorts of surfaces, the sorts of regions that one can consider, and some of them are more restrictive than others. So, for example, you could imagine variations where, for example, as Gerhardt and Tom Ullmann used, where instead of putting in the no stable closed minimal surfaces, one said that omega had to be outer minimizing, and we're only looking at extensions with respect to which omega is outer, the boundary of omega is outer minimizing in the extension. And that it's a fairly subtle difference between the two. But it does mean that in particular there's a restriction on the type of omega that one uses, that one can apply. It can't be non-convex. And in some sense there's a certain amount of non-locality that then arises because of the outer minimizing condition. So So we've got property 0. It is well defined, at least on a fairly large class of regions. It's immediate from the definition that the we have the monotonicity property. Bigger region has a smaller, has a larger mass, and that really just comes back from these, comes back to the property that an extension of the larger region will automatically, by the isometric containment condition, will automatically mean that it's an extension of the smaller region. So the infimum for the smaller region must be less than the infimum for the larger region. So this is a direct monotonicity argument. It would be nice to know conditions under which equality is satisfied. I can certainly conjecture things, but that's a long way from being proved. Okay, now what other properties do I need to mention here? There were various other ones that I mentioned in the last lecture. Particular, well, yeah, that's right. We need ADM compatibility, and this comes in two forms. Type A is closely related to condition 2. It says, if omega is contained in some manifold in PM0, then trivially the infimum mass is less than or equal to the ADM mass. Now the second condition, now that just follows directly from the definition, but it does tell you that first of all that it's controlled by the ADM mass of any extension, or at least an upper bound. Secondly, because we're looking at the infimum over all extensions, this shows you that the infimum definition gives you the largest number satisfying the ADM compatibility condition. That is, given any other definition of quasi-local mass which satisfies the ADM compatibility condition, it will automatically be dominated by this definition. So the second ADM compatibility condition, slightly different style of thing, says that if you've got a PM manifold given an exhaustion, say, let's say, it's true that the quasi-local mass of the finite sets exhaustion will tend to the ADM mass of M. Proof of this fact, well, this one was trivial. This one is a lot more subtle, again, is due to Gerhardt. It's a consequence of the inverse mean curvature flow. When you get out to infinity, monotonicity takes over.
And Tom.
Hmm? And Tom, sorry, yes, of course. Okay, so we've got ADM compatibility. I think the other conditions were things like usefulness and so on.
Robert, you didn't specify, you didn't put any asymptotic conditions on the extension.
I said asymptotically flat.
Yeah.
Now, that's I guess, a little bit vague.
Yeah, because presumably you wanted to have at least a well-defined ADMS.
Yes, that's what I mean by asymptotically flat.
Now, what would happen if I, instead of saying just, you know, in some sort of weighted Sobolev space, r to the minus a half the k, I assume, say, asymptotically Schwarzschildian? Would I change the number?
No. No. Well, you can see that you could do cut and paste arguments. You see, the point is, because you're taking an infimum, you're just getting within epsilon, you've always got an epsilon range that you can make variations on. So, no, asymptotically Schwarzschildian would be fine. Yeah, no, that shouldn't cause a problem. Okay, now, let's see, we've got monotone. There are two other conditions which I did mention. Has useful consequences. And this is, again, a very subjective thing. There isn't a direct one that I can think of here. Some of the other definitions certainly do have additional useful consequences, but there isn't a good one here. So I'll put a question mark there. And finally, we have, I guess you could count this as being a useful definition, what I'd call a black hole. Or, if you like, a hoop conjecture type of result, saying that if you have too much, if the quasi-local mass is too large, then a black hole must have formed. Point being is that there is a simple argument that shows that this property is satisfied, a version of this property. You know, you'll notice I've left the actual formalism rather vague here, quite intentionally, which holds in this condition. This was originally a comment of Walter Simon, and it works as follows. Suppose, first of all, we're given a region, omega, and it has mass greater than or equal to 1. Suppose that we're given a extension of omega where the extension is satisfies the conditions of the positive mass theorem, but we do not impose the no horizon condition, the zero, if you like. Such that the ADM mass of this guy M is equal, less than or equal to 1/2. And this tells you that, first of all, we have an extension which has mass less than the quasi-local mass, the infimum mass. So something in the conditions because we know that this is impossible just by definition. One of the conditions has to have been violated, and the only condition that I've left over is the no horizons condition. So, structure of this is, you assume you have a region which has too much mass, it sits inside a space-time which has too little mass, then there must be a black hole. So it's a cheap, very cheap construction, but it does give you a quite explicit condition which you can test, which you can at least express mathematically for the existence of a black hole. And I certainly, well, there are a couple of definitions which, ways of in which one can construct such. Well, there's a result due to Shane and Rick and Yao, of course, on black hole collapse, but which assumes a large amount of scalar curvature, or a large amount of boundary curvature. That's more recent work of Yao's.
So what's actually being proved here is the existence of a stable minimal surface.
Yes, yes. So I'm using, being very sloppy here, I'm using black hole as equivalent to stable minimal two-sphere, essentially. Is equivalent to a horizon, is equivalent to the little zero up in PM. Okay. All right, so I think at that point I'll stop on the conditions of the infimum definition and look a little bit at what the structure should be like. So this is, I guess, expectations. I guess I should add that just recently Tam and Shi have essentially worked this program through, in the sense that the critical thing is to actually get something that you can actually find an explicit lower bound on the quasi-local mass for, and they did this using the inverse mean curvature flow along the lines suggested by Gerhardt and Tom to get a region for which they could explicitly estimate the lower bound, a positive lower bound on the quasi-local mass, on the infimum mass, and they derived this as a consequence. Okay, so the expectations are that you've got, first of all, a sequence of smooth metrics. We're looking for the infimum, so we can assume we have a sequence of extensions, MK or GK, and the ADM mass of the limit of this sequence is realized by a explicit smooth metric. So it'll be a metric which is going to have non-negative scalar curvature everywhere. It'll be asymptotically flat in whatever. Well, if we're looking at the limit, we can't be so explicit. We can't insist that it be asymptotically Schwarzschildian, for example. There'll be more general conditions being satisfied. It's asymptotically flat. It's it's got scalar curvature greater than or equal to zero, and at this point, life becomes a little bit more complicated, because we know that the sequence, of course, will be fixed on omega, but away from omega, it's going to have a lot of room to vary. And in particular, it may well be the case that you lose some continuity conditions or some matching conditions at the boundary of the region omega sitting inside these extensions. But in the interior, we expect that G will be static. In fact, this follows from a result of Rick and Justin Corvino. And that argument works as follows. but it can also be done variationally. But the way their argument works is, first of all, try and one looks at the linearization. So we try and solve a perturbation problem. So we look at metric G, we look at a perturbation H, we want the scalar curvature of this to be greater than or equal to zero. Assume that G, for example, is a zero scalar curvature metric. Now, or so this comes down to solving a linearized problem, at least first of all a linearized problem. Tells you that we want the functional derivative of R, the first variation, hitting our variation vector H, should be approximately equal to this variation term S. So we should be able to solve this, in particular with S being something positive. Think about this as being zero and S being positive. That means we're trying to actually increase the amount of scalar curvature around. That should be possible if, provided this is a surjective operator. So this is the essence of what they proved. If we know that the derivative is surjective, then we can find, for S small enough, an H. That is, provided this operator is surjective, we can always increase the amount of scalar curvature in the spacetime, in the three-manifold. And if we can increase the amount of scalar curvature, if I can make it more positive, then we can do a conformal transformation and actually increase the mass. So that would be a contradiction to, the conformal change will decrease the mass. Because we're going to have...
That's right, getting rid of positive mass decreases.
Yeah, sorry. Ah, oh, there they are. Okay, so if I can make one of these sorts of changes, then I can decrease the mass, and this contradicts minimality. So if we have a minimizing solution, if G is a minimizing metric, then it must be one for which dr is not surjective. Now that means that there's something in the kernel of the adjoint. And this says exactly that G is a static metric. Because the kernel is, this adjoint operator is just the Hessian operator plus Ricci and so on. So this is one way of showing that a direct proof that if you have a minimizer, then it must be static. But this sort of argument doesn't apply across the boundary, of course. So then you have to think about what the boundary conditions must be. And the simplest boundary conditions one can impose is just that the scalar curvature be distributionally well-defined and non-negative at the boundary. So we don't expect smoothness. We've got smooth on either side, but the matching conditions will perhaps not have the required continuity for smoothness, but we will have enough to have the scalar curvature being non-negative. That is, we've got a sequence of smooth metrics. We expect if the sequence all consists of non-negative scalar curvature, that the limit will also have non-negative scalar curvature, and that imposes the condition R is greater than or equal to zero distributionally. And the distribution is going to be measured by looking at the derivatives transverse to the boundary, across the boundary in the scalar curvature. And the derivatives across the boundary in the scalar curvature come from the second variation formula, which we by now know and love. Scalar curvature is equal to 2 times derivative in the normal direction of the mean curvature. And now I'll get it wrong. Second fundamental form squared plus k, maybe there's 2k, yes, okay, this will do for the situation where we've taken the boundary and we've looked at Gaussian, adapted Gaussian coordinates about the boundary, that is constant distance surfaces. So we're assuming that the metric is dr squared plus g of r, where g of r is the metric on the slices. And if I calculate the scalar curvature for this metric, I'll end up with something along these along these lines. And in particular, the piece that's going to be a problem is this one here. If we want the normal derivative to be well-behaved, that means we're going to have to say that the mean curvature is continuous. Now, these other pieces, even if we have jumps in these, because we're not differentiating across the boundary, these ones are going to be well-behaved. So we'll have no distributional components if the jump across the two sides now, in fact, you could put this get a sign condition in there if you liked, and we're also going to require that the boundary metric also include no jumps. Why is that? Because if there was a jump in the boundary metric, the second fundamental form, which is the radial derivative, the transverse derivative of that, would have a delta function, then the square it, you've got the square of a delta function, and forget it. Okay, so what this tells us is that these are going to be necessary conditions for the limiting metric to satisfy. So this gives us what I call the geometric boundary conditions. The mean curvature on the boundary, or the mean curvature across the boundary, should match, and the boundary metric should match as well. So then becomes a question of showing that, we expect that this is achieved by a metric G. You can look at various other variants of this to try and prove decide whether or not you really believe that this is true. And we have the following results of Peng-Jin Miao in his thesis. He showed that these geometric boundary conditions, augmented by some diffeomorphism conditions as well, are elliptic. And one can form an implicit function theorem argument. There exists, given h and g close to the standard ones for the two sphere in R3, sorry, I don't recall the precise details of the function spaces that are involved here. Close to h equals 2 on r, g equals r squared, d omegas. Yes. The two-sphere metric then there exists a static metric with those boundary conditions. There is one catch that I should point out, and that is that co-kernel reasons, he had to assume a symmetry condition, that is that the solution be symmetric under reflection in each of the three coordinate planes, the data be symmetric. So there we're looking at sort of a balancing condition, I guess would be the way to say it. So what this tells, this isn't necessarily the minimum. What this is just finding is a static metric. The conjecture about whether this is the minimum, the minimizing metric, is another story. We know that the minimizer is static. We don't know that a static implies minimizing. A uniqueness theorem for static metrics would help a lot in this regard.
So the boundary conditions, I mean, these aren't conditions on the initial domain.
They're conditions on the exterior.
So you want to think of them as the exterior in a proposed minimizer?
Yeah, that's right. Okay, so you've got omega here. You're trying to construct an extremal. So first and foremost, it's an extension. They have to construct an extension. Now you want an extension which has the property that it's the least. So by the linearization arguments here, or by direct perturbation arguments, which I'll talk about a bit on Monday, you know that the exterior must be static. So now, if you knew that there was exactly one static metric satisfying the boundary conditions, then you'd be home. Right? You'd know that that would have to be the minimizer. Until we actually have a uniqueness theorem, then this is open. Now,
so he gives you an existence theorem for a static one satisfying the boundary.
Yeah, exactly.
If you give me a car, which is your omega, then I expect that there is a static metric which this car sort of acts as a kernel for.
Yeah.
But if I give you two cars, you can't. So if omega is it consists of two disjoint sets, I don't see how you can construct it through your static metric.
Exactly, that's true. I can think of one situation where it's very plausible that one could construct a static metric where you were given two boundary components. But in general, you have to assume that omega is connected. Otherwise, you have the problem that you know that if they're a long way apart, you're going to get a different mass from when they're close together. So somehow you need some idea of measurement of what the distance between them is, and you don't have anything to any way of doing that intrinsically. You're quite right.
Yeah.
So let me just briefly follow up on that point that you led me to. Take the following situation. Take the Schwarzschild space-time. Now, if there's any justice in heaven, the Schwarzschild metric will realize the quasi-local mass. The infimum mass will be given by the standard Schwarzschild mass. Now let's take a little region way out here. Very tiny. What's its quasi-local mass? Now you have here an extension already, which includes this big black hole. Now, I said that there are no black holes, but I also mentioned, as Gerhard and Tom pointed out, that you could allow black holes as long as they didn't intersect the boundary. Right, so they could either be completely within the region that you have or completely outside the region you have. Well, here we have an example where it's completely outside the region that we have. I mean, this is a smooth piece of space-time. So the quasi-local mass of this region should be something. We know that it's less than or equal to the mass, essentially, of this big black hole, but it should be a lot less because this is very close to flat, as close as we would like it to flat to be. So the quasi-local mass of this So here we have a situation where you have two possible extensions. Right, there should be That's not quite what I was saying before. It should be one extent. Well, here's one extension, which just corresponds to just taking this guy and making it as small as we can. And here we have another extension, which involves having a large black hole somewhere outside. So uniqueness in general will not be true. That is, I've demonstrated to you two admissible extensions of this region. Right? One which has a what we think should be the right mass, and one which is way off. So it's not quite the same as what you're saying, where you have two boundary components. Mm-hmm. Okay. So associated with this infimum question, or at least the existence of solutions satisfying the necessary conditions, it seems to me, well, it would be very nice to have a direct proof that if you had a minimizing sequence, then it would converge to the minimizing metric, which is certainly what one would expect, because the minimizer is smooth, actually analytic, and there should be something there. But actually proving it seems to be rather tricky. The trouble is that you can have a lot of variation coming out of this. You can sort of diffeomorph the metric around and really make a quite nice metric look very, very rough. So the proving this statement, this expectation, I think is a major challenge. Having said which, there is a situation where you can get something useful out of the minimizer, which to my knowledge hasn't been fully explored, and this is an old idea of Vince's. So if you look at perturbations of the Schwarzschild metric, then you can write the perturbations as a sum of squares. That is, the ADM mass becomes, or the Hamiltonian. At least on the linearized level, around Schwarzschild. These are the so-called gauge invariant quantities, and this exhibits the Hamiltonian as being something positive definite. And so there you have a situation where if you're close to flat, you should be able to get some sort of estimate, for example, on these absolute modes. But to my knowledge, no one's ever been able to get that to really work. Okay, I think I've probably prattled on enough, long enough about this. What I'd like to do now is to talk about a couple of other definitions. In particular, the Shi-Tam and the Dugan-Mason constructions, and see what sort of properties they satisfy. So this is the Brown-York mass now. I don't know anything about the physical background that motivated them to this definition, but it works as follows. So we're given a region, let's talk about just the boundary, which is convex. So by that we mean the Gauss curvature of the metric of sigma is greater than or equal to zero. Actually, strictly greater than zero is going to be... it's an interesting point. I think we could probably get by with... then we're going to have embedding problems. And we also require that the mean curvature be greater than zero. Now, once we have a non-negative scalar, a positive scalar curvature two-manifold, we know that there's an isometric embedding. Into R3. back of the flat metric. And right, okay, and we can also now look at the mean curvature of the embedded surface. So we'll let H...
Unique isometric embedding.
Unique up to rigid motions, yes. Well, we only need one. The uniqueness isn't actually necessary here. All I need is one. So let me call H0 is equal to the mean curvature function of sigma 0, which is just phi 0 of sigma, with respect to the flat metric on R3. So using curly H as the mean curvature operator, if you like. Okay, now I'm going to...
the table.
Thanks. The next thing I need is a way of extending this to a foliation of R3. And I'll do this as follows. First of all, I actually have enough here. I'm not sure about this constant. So it's an integral over sigma. With respect to, well, because it's an isometric embedding, it doesn't really matter. The metrics are both the same. But H0 minus H So we're looking at the difference between the embedding mean curvature and the original mean curvature, which at this stage we've got no control on over at all. But the first basic property is that this is greater than or equal to zero, and it satisfies the rigidity property. Now, round the orthogonometer is greater than or equal to zero. Yep. Well, we could think about this as sigma, provided that there's a condition here. Of course, omega bounds. That is, the scalar curvature of omega is non-negative, and it has no boundary condition. Yeah, I should be talking about boundary of omega bounds. Well, omega has scalar curvature non-negative and no horizons in whatever sense you like. Well, let's say complete. Okay, so how does the proof go? I think I'm going to... taking out the ADM compatibility condition, but we'll see that that's not satisfied. So, the way the construction works is to construct a foliation of R3. So here's our region sigma 0 sitting inside R3. We set up Gaussian coordinates around this. So we now look at the flat metric on R3. So it's going to be dr squared, where r is the distance from the surface sigma 0, plus a metric on the surface as r equals constant, the leaves of the expansion. Because this is convex, we know that this foliation will go out to infinity. So if you want to think about... the level sets as being sigma r, then sigma r so if we take a point P on sigma, then we've got its embedding point, we've got its normal vector, we just go out a distance r. So it becomes a straightforward exercise to calculate essentially all the geometry that's associated with this. The interesting part comes... Actually, I guess I could probably... summarize at least one formula that matters here. Yes. First of all, from these conditions here, the metric on the R level sets, sigma R, will satisfy d by dr of root gr. The volume form is just the mean curvature of the level sets, the derivative root g. That's really just the definition of the mean curvature. And more importantly is the derivative of this guy, which you can calculate directly or by the second variation formula again. And let's see. We can take our pick. Let's say 2 times the Gauss curvature. We're sitting inside surfaces inside R3, so this is not particularly complicated. Now we come to the second idea. This is really the real big idea of Xi and Tam. Is now consider a different metric now, one which is just obtained from the metric, the flat metric, by warping the radial factor, where U is to be determined. So let's give that guy an X. Let's call it the S hat. So we choose U such that the scalar curvature of the S hat is equal to 0 for R greater than 0. And again, the scalar curvature is going to throw up a derivative of a normal vector, of a mean curvature. And this is going to tell us that d by dr of u is equal to 1 on h0 Details of this are not particularly important, at least not to start with. The important point is that we get a formula involving the derivative of u, and we have this Laplacian term here. So this is a parabolic equation in the outward direction. And the origin of this equation really comes from the comparison between the mean curvature with respect to the warped metric and the mean curvature with respect to the unwarped metric. The difference is only in the normal vector, so the mean curvature in the unwarped direction will be 1 on u, the mean curvature of the unwarped metric. And if I take a normal derivative, I'm going to throw up a term which involves the radial derivative of u, and this is the dominant term here. Okay, now from this formula we see that, well, what we would like to do is to choose u to satisfy this equation, and such that the mean curvature of the boundary of the warped metric match the mean curvature of the given region omega. And that comes down to exactly the boundary conditions. So the initial boundary conditions will be H0 on H sigma. H sigma being the warped metric that we want. Okay, so if we do this, then the warped metric on R3 minus phi of sigma on the exterior component of this, and so we've got the embedded surface sigma 0. We can take the omega metric and put it on the region here. And that tells us that the ADM mass of the warped metric with this matching condition is non-negative. Now something really amazing happens. We have up there a formula for the derivative of the mean curvature. So from this we can actually calculate the radial derivative and we'll integrate around the level set so that we get rid of the Laplacian term of so this will be an integral over sigma r with respect to the metric on the level sets. It's the same for the two metrics, so we've got all the pieces that we need to actually calculate this derivative, and the end result is that it's equal to minus the integral of the Gauss curvature over sigma r of 1 minus u all squared, which is less than or equal to 0. And that tells us that the Brown-York mass is greater than or equal to, because it's decreasing, the ADM mass, which is greater than zero, or greater than or equal to zero. And in and you can get very tight information about the what happens in the intermediate state if you have equality all the way through here. So, for example, U must be constant, and that tells you that you're basically in R3. So one consequence that comes out of this, because the things that you're differentiating are just the Brown-York masses of the intermediate regions, tells you that the intermediate regions form a sequence of metrics which actually have mass greater than their ADM mass. That is, you choose this point here or this one up here, then we've got an asymptotically flat extension of this data set, and we know that its mass is strictly greater than the ADM mass of the limit. So although you know that the limit is the ADM mass, it's not satisfying the monotonicity inequality that you require. It's actually more positive than the ADM mass. Now, whether you think that this is a desirable property or an undesirable property is by the by. It's a property and there it is, and we have to live with that. I think it's probably a good spot for me to stop at this stage. There was a lot more that I wanted to say, but I need to go a bit faster than I've been going up until now. Thanks very much. Sorry.
Questions?
Just one completely trivial comet, Jimmy would be very upset to call that a mass.
Ah, yes, yes. Well,
it's an energy.
Okay, call it the energy. That's fine. I don't have any objection to that. I agree.
Or object. Changes under.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
It's not a.
Can I just ask? In that case, he would say that the momentum parts would be, say, the first spherical harmonics put against here, the x1.
What it would be is basically the same as the ADM momentum at infinity. So it's the integral of pi ij dot ni.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. That one. Right. So he would just it would be an expression which what's happening is that the Brownian energy is just the ADM energy pushed in, and the Brownian momentum is the ADM momentum pushed in. Because he's, you know, a long time ago, he showed that expression at infinity is the ADM energy. H0 minus H at infinity is the ADM energy. You missed that statement as you were going through. That object is the ADM energy.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's this limiting thing over there. Yes, I guess I'm still confused, but I'll come and ask you about this afterwards rather than take everyone's time.
Concerning the existence result of Peng Zhaomiao, it's a small data result.
Absolutely. But I don't see that
that condition known that. For reasonably large data result.
Well, the ellipticity of the boundary conditions still holds. I mean, that's not a small data result.
Right.
What that tells you is your implicit function continuation continues on. Now, how far it reaches is still another question.
There are no geometric conditions on the data known that allow you to get a priori estimates sort of for larger data.
No, but if one were asked to conjecture, to speculate, it would be, for example, the first step would be to say convex. If you just assume convex as you have here.
That would be great. You think there's a result so general?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I should add that, in fact, it's kind of embarrassing, at least up till about a year ago, I was working with Marsha Weaver on the problem of doing this numerically in the axially symmetric case. Now, the numerics are very delicate, and I was never completely happy with the errors. The numerical errors were sufficient to actually draw very firm conclusions from, but we were able to solve to some degree of accuracy that I wouldn't bet with my life, that even in the non-convex case, that these can be solved, at least as long as it's mildly non-convex. If it's extremely non-convex, then there are there's boundary problems. But that's a long way from a formal existence proof. I mean, the technique was very ad hoc. Very ad hoc, which is the sort of thing you can do in numerics, but maybe even in the PDE becomes a little bit more problematic.
You see any? As I know, in the Shi-Tan proof, they construct completely new, you know, it's only the interior is kept the same. The exterior is completely new. If I were given if I gave you a manifold, is there any hope that one might be able to find a foliation outside a certain bounded set which would satisfy the same thing?
Well, to start with, you'd need something which was zero, which was flat. Oh, so what do you mean by the same thing? You want a foliation which...
I would like the question...
Not necessarily a flat space, but...
For which the Brownian energy monotonically decreased, for example.
So you want to say, instead of using the flat metric as your sort of seed... So instead of using this metric as your seed, you'd like some other metric here,
yes.
And then you would go for some comparison against that.
So the question is,
it's potentially doable.
In a given slice of a given space-time, could I actually construct a sequence of surfaces, each with a Brownian energy, so that the Brownian energy decreased as I went out? Clearly, it will depend on your choice of tooth foliation.
Yeah.
You know, could I get something which looked like that in a particular space-like slice, in a given space-like slice?
So in particular, that satisfied the monotonicity of the decreasing condition.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. Certainly one could do that. You could do the calculations. So you could end up calculating what this is, but whether you could get all of the variations, the non-flat pieces, to match up is...
It trivially works in moment of time symmetry Schwarzschild, which is completely boring, obviously, but
yeah,
there
yeah.
you can actually do it by hand.
Yeah. Yes, well, any sort of angular variation becomes has to be controlled.
I realize this, I'm just trying to
guess
whether there is something absolutely wonderful lurking somewhere.
Well, what would be good, for example, would be something which... So it's decreasing to the ADM. You can't really do much better than that. So what you would like to be able to do is to somehow get something which, instead of starting off way up here, starts off somewhere down here. I don't know. I've tried a couple of things as variations, slightly different functionals, for example, but there doesn't seem to be anything completely obvious. There was one interesting... I'll save this comment for discussions later, but there are relations with isoperimetric inequalities and so on, all hidden through this, particularly in the round York. There's an argument of TAM, for example, which proves the Minkowski inequality. But anyone that's interested, I can show that afterwards. I know, this is for GitHub, but we're getting late and food is waiting, so.
Thank Robert again.